Hi, welcome to the Yes to Life show on UK Health Radio. I'm Robin Daly, introducing the show as usual, and also founder of Yes to Life, the UK's integrative cancer care charity, which supports people with cancer in the UK in understanding and using integrative medicine to help themselves. Among the vast range of fascinating people I get to talk to on the Yes to Life show are research scientists, people working to push the frontiers of our understanding of cancer and how to combat it. I always find this really interesting and always learn new things that expand my layman's understanding of cancer and the problem it presents us. So this week is one of those forays into the world of research, and actually research into a subject we've never broached on this show: oncolytic viruses and viral oncology. So what does this mean? Well, it means the study of viruses and cancer, but not just viruses as a cause of cancer, which we've heard a lot about, but also viruses to treat cancer, a much less appreciated subject. Dr. Stephen Griffin is an associate professor at Leeds University, and he heads up the antivirals and viral oncology research group there. I'm speaking to him over the internet. Hi, Steve. Thanks so much for joining us on the show today.
That's a pleasure, Robin. Hi.
So, you lead the antivirals and viral oncology research group at the University of Leeds. For many people,
yes, that's right,
the term viral oncology will probably only point to the concept of viruses being yet another thing from the Daily Mail limitless list of things that can cause cancer. Well, it's certainly true that viruses haven't had the greatest press just lately. I think it's fair to say that viral oncology actually refers to a strand of research that has some quite optimistic news to share on cancer.
Yes, that's true. So we actually look at both aspects. We look at how viruses cause cancer, but also how we can use certain viruses as a form of what we call immunotherapy to target cancers.
Interesting. All right. Well, look, I'm really looking forward to digging into this territory. I don't know very much about it at all. I think we're set for one of those shows where we run out of time long before I run out of questions. But anyway, just as a general comment at the outset, how interested should people be in what's happening in viral oncology, in your opinion?
Well, I think, you know, it's safe to say that the recent use of what we would call immunotherapy, which people may have come across more in terms of these antibodies, which serve to sort of take the brakes off your immune response, so these checkpoint antibodies that people may have heard of, we can see that that is having tremendous success in immunotherapy. And that really does show us the power of our immune response in terms of tackling cancer. Viruses represent another way of achieving immunotherapy. And immunotherapy is a very broad term. It really just means any kind of manipulation of your immune response that serves to have a beneficial effect. Okay, so the viruses, rather than generally taking the brakes off, which is what the antibodies do, they tend to more sort of put the foot down on the accelerator. So they act as a stimulation to your immune response to try and tackle your cancer.
Right. Yeah, well, you're right. This is definitely a growing area, which I think the public are probably becoming more aware of. The concept of harnessing the body's own immune system, or encouraging it or whatever, in order to tackle cancer is definitely much more broadly accepted and known about. Okay, so going forward, you'll have to excuse me if I ask some pretty basic questions along the way, or get you to explain terminology that you take for granted. But I myself am no kind of scientist, and nor are most of my listeners, but that doesn't mean to say we're not interested in the topic. So when I was growing up, the only appropriate response to bacteria was annihilation with a potent toxic chemical, and a huge industry was built around this view. So later on in life, I get to find out that we're actually walking bacteria colonies, that I've got more of these critters in me than my own cells. And in fact, they're at the very heart of the immune system that keeps me safe and alive, even protects me from cancer. So Now that bacteria looked on a little more kindly, it does seem that viruses have taken their place as the bad guys we're up against. But is this really true, or are viruses actually also a foundational part of our makeup?
Well, yeah, certainly viruses have evolved with us over millennia. And you can see that in our DNA. Much of our DNA is actually made of viral sequences. But that's probably for another day. I think with any infectious agent, it's a question of being in the wrong place in the wrong time.
Right.
Okay? So, you know, many of the bacteria that you mentioned that cause serious diseases will only do so if it happens under certain circumstances.
Right.
So many of us live with those sorts of bacteria in our bodies, but they don't cause disease unless something tips that balance. And a lot of nature is about balance. So, I think you're right in that, you know, certainly at the moment viruses have got a very bad press.
Right.
And that's absolutely right and proper, because viruses are a very severe threat to human health, and we are indeed working on SARS, as you might imagine. But the understanding more about how our bodies interact with either bacteria or viruses allows us to use those interactions, hopefully, to our benefit.
Right. Okay, so it's as you say, it's a case of the right thing at the right time or the wrong thing at the wrong time, and as to whether they're a threat or actually just part of general life.
Yeah.
Okay, so I'm reasonably familiar with the concept of bacteria being used as a treatment for cancer, going back to the work of William Coley over 100 years ago, but I can't really claim to know anything about viruses being used in this context, so can I ask whether it's fair to say that bacteria and viruses share a common territory when it comes to treating cancer? Are they similar concepts in some way?
So actually, Coley's toxin, which you're referring to, is a very similar idea.
Yeah,
okay. So it's a very similar idea where it acts as a broadly acting stimulus to our immune response. And in so doing, we hope that that can counteract some of the sort of effects that tumours have on our immune responses, which generally is to dampen them down. So tumours really don't like having an active immune response ongoing in them. And you can see that when people have successful therapy with immunotherapy. You can also see that when people are immunocompromised and they're more prone to developing cancer. So, you know, the balance of our immune response, I mean, it's not the only entire answer by any stretch of the imagination, but our immune response has evolved to maintain the integrity of our bodies and to do away with invasive and threatening entities. And the problem we have with cancer is that that entity is derived from our own bodies. So it's a slightly more complex question than an invading pathogen in some ways.
Yes, yes.
So what you have to do is try and manipulate your immune response to act in a way that it might otherwise not do. And that's the trick. So we would refer to that as what we call tolerance. So our immune response not doing anything about the tumour is what we would call immune tolerance. So if you can break that tolerance to your tumour, allow your body to recognise that that tumour is a threat and mount an appropriate response to it, that's the rationale for immunotherapy. So one way of doing that is to, as I say, take the brakes off and unleash a more powerful response with these antibodies that people use. Another way to do that is to give it a big sort of push, and things like Coley's toxin and our oncolytic viruses that we're here to talk about today are another way of doing that.
Right. And to compare the two, using bacteria or using viruses, are viruses the next step on? Are they more effective in some way?
Well, they have different properties, but what they're trying to achieve is triggering our bodies, what we call innate defences, at least initially. So our bodies are primed within every cell to recognise the presence of literally foreign matter. So things like proteins and nucleic acids, so the stuff that would make, you know, our DNA or RNA in a virus sometimes. When they're in the wrong place at the wrong time, again, that triggers a very pronounced response by these innate pathways, which are just set to trip and activate your immune system straight away, then can give rise to a more tailored and specific response, which we would call our adaptive response, where you would make antibodies and have cytotoxic T cells that come in and kill tumor cells. So we want to try and stimulate both of these arms of the immune response to try and tackle our cancers.
Right, right. Something else, looking at a comparison between bacteria and viruses, I know that during the life of using bacteria as a treatment, Coley started off using live bacteria and actually moved on to using dead bacteria, as they found they work quite as well without killing as many patients. So has something similar happened with viruses? Are they used live or dead?
Well, that's actually a very interesting question, because most of them are indeed used live. Most of them are usually attenuated, so lessened in their pathogenicity, so their disease-causing ability. And that can be done either naturally through a pathogen that doesn't really cause severe disease in human, or it can be genetically engineered to do that, or we can manipulate it in the lab to do that. So take away its sort of natural vigor, as it were. But also, one of the projects that we've been exploring in the lab recently is indeed using a killed virus to approach therapy for liver cancer.
And what have you found out so far?
That's interesting in terms of safety.
Yeah. Is it looking like it's comparable in terms of its action?
It's subtly different. So yes, it does work. In fact, I mean, this isn't published yet, but it's something that we've just had funded by the Medical Research Council. And it's where we've taken something called reovirus. Reovirus is a virus that causes very mild tummy upsets and cold-like symptoms in young children, but has been used in many, many human trials as an oncolytic, so cancer-lysing or just killing virus. And we found that whilst that virus does have some effect in our models, so bear in mind these are only animal models in the lab.
Okay.
When we have used our killed version of the virus in combination with another drug, particularly, we actually find it works just as well on its own, if not slightly better, but actually works far better when we combine it with this drug that's already been used to treat liver cancer. So that's really exciting, and we're beginning to understand by that is that the virus is actually stimulating that innate response that we talked about just now in a slightly different way to how the live virus does. And it may be that doing that is the sort of thing that underpins this being a more successful therapy.
And is it an over-technical question to ask what the slightly different is?
No, not really. So there are different aspects to that sort of standby response, some of which cause sort of direct responses that would kind of disable the invading pathogen or virus, some of which sort of promote a generalized inflammatory state, and so attract other white blood cells and what have. This seems to be more geared towards the former. So the approach it seems to be activating something called interferon, which you may have heard of.
Yes.
Particularly something called interferon beta, and various different signals which are attracting certain types of other white blood cells towards the tumours in these livers. But I do stress that this is very much experimental at this stage. But reovirus is known to work in trial scenarios. But what we'd actually look to do in the future is, as I said, mentioning combining with this drug, is to combine the viruses with other forms of cancer therapy, because combinations in cancer tend to work better because they can evolve resistance and become harder to treat if you just give them one series of therapy.
Well, that's always been the issue with cancer, hasn't it? Is that it doesn't matter how good a treatment is, it usually has a limited life because cancer's so blooming smart at finding some way around. But these combinations do seem to be the way forward, and It's stunning what is happening in terms of just bringing in an added ingredient to an absolutely bog-standard treatment that's been used for years, is moderately successful, but suddenly is improved several-fold by adding in another ingredient.
Yes, that's right. And this drug in particular that we're looking at is something called serafinib.
Mm-hmm.
And what that does is it manipulates some of the growth signals that cells need to divide. And, of course, cancer cells need those signals more than our normal bodies because cancers are dividing and growing much more quickly. And so serafinib is actually used to treat liver cancers and some related drugs.
Mm.
What we're finding is that it's not so much the sort of anti-cancer effect per se of that drug. It's more the combination that the drug kind of conditions the tumor, the signaling and the immune responses, to receive this stimulus with the virus.
Hmm.
So by altering the response to the virus as well, we think the combination of those two entities are giving a much better therapy and, in fact, potentially a synergistic therapy, so working actively together rather than just being the sum of two things.
Hmm.
We think that that's working tremendously well, but I hasten to add, in the laboratory,
in
this stage. Yeah.
Well, I've talked to a few people on this show who are doing work into, you know, what would be considered far from frontline approaches, but a kind of natural therapies that, when integrated with the standard therapy, actually make an enormous difference. And it's very striking how this can happen, you know, with a simple vitamin. So, it looks like a very interesting area of research.
Yeah, certainly. I mean, we know that there's a tremendous interest in combining viruses like this with the existing forms of immunotherapy that were already licensed. So the antibodies, the ipilimumabs and all the rest of it, that are the checkpoint inhibitors, are being combined with viruses in trials. And I should also mention there are viruses that are, in fact, licensed therapies for cancers already.
Are there?
So, there's a virus, something called a herpes simplex virus, that's been genetically modified that people use to treat skin cancer, for example.
Hmm.
So there is precedent there for these things being very well tolerated and very useful clinical agents already. And if we can understand how to use them properly and to the best of their ability, then, you know, we can see great things happening in the future, hopefully.
Yeah, great. All right, one other area I want to ask, we've talked about this sort of overlap with bacteria. Is there any overlap with the work that you're doing and dendritic cell therapy, where kind of personalised vaccines are created to retrain the immune system to recognise cancer cells?
Sure. Well, I mean, dendritic cells are the sort of cornerstone of the sort of bridge between that innate response and what we would call the adaptive response. So dendritic cells are important in programming, as you mentioned, the more tailored aspects of the immune response towards killing the tumour.
Mm.
Where people are designing dendritic cell vaccines, they're tend to be, you know, using the tumour itself to try and stimulate those. So you use material from the tumour and you either very specifically or in a very broad brushstroke, feed the dendritic cell almost that information in terms of the proteins that are present, or you can program them genetically to present those targets for your adaptive immune response. And we hope, achieve a similar outcome by adding in our viruses and causing this quite broad immune activation, because once you start to get death in the tumor itself as a result of the response, that will also liberate these targets, these antigens, which will get presented in dendritic cells to our adaptive immune responses. And certainly we know that the adaptive immune response in our models is important as well as the innate immune response. So yes, all these things do link together. It's wise to try and integrate as many aspects of the effective responses as you can. So yes, certainly dendritic cells are a cornerstone to oncolytic virus therapy, certainly.
Great. Now, just going back to something you said earlier, you talked about the fact that this, you describe your work as effectively putting your foot on the gas, basically, with the immune system. Mm-hmm. So that, to me, says that immediately there are types of cancer for which this is just not suitable at all, because in those the immune system is already overdoing it. Is that right?
Well, no. Generally, the immune response is suppressed by tumours. So they... if you compare the ability of white blood cells that invade certain tumours to respond to a target or to chemical stimulation that would otherwise activate them to go on and kill infected cells, for example, if you compare those within a tumour to those either extraneous to the tumour or in your blood supply, you can very readily show for the majority of tumours that's actually... that ability has been greatly diminished. And that's because tumours have tricks that they play to basically convince the immune response that it's not time to act.
Right.
And one of those tricks is something that the antibody-mediated immunotherapies target. So these checkpoints, which tell the immune system to switch off, are what those antibodies will target, a particular target called PD-L1 on tumour cells. But they also secrete things we call cytokines, which are signals, which will suppress the response of white blood cells. So ideally, you will try and re-stimulate that immune response. There are examples of tumours where there are ongoing inflammatory processes, and indeed inflammation can itself be a cause of cancer,
right,
where you have a chronic inflammatory state, where you get high cell growth and turnover. But that's a slightly different aspect here. We're talking about after the tumour has formed, we're trying to re-stimulate those immune responses.
Right. But you've been talking all the time about solid tumours. What in the case of blood cancer or a lymph cancer?
Yeah, sure. That's an important question. It's something that a colleague of mine, Fiona Errington Mays, is looking at.
Mm-hmm.
So lymphomas and myelomas and things. And they are tricky to treat, because obviously you've got tumour cells in your circulation and also in your bone marrow. But Fiona is certainly showing efficacy for various different oncolytic virus therapies against blood cancers. So we're, and again, in laboratory models, but there are trials ongoing as well. Certainly blood cancers are a harder target to hit in some ways. But yes, we would hope that the same sort of tactic and strategy is applicable to blood cancers as well.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so given that it's early days in terms of you knowing what works and what doesn't, I'm just interested to know what you have found out. You've already talked about the fact that it seems that these are a great adjunct to conventional treatments, and that may be the best way to use them. Do you have any sense of any particular cancer types that it might be, really well suited to, that possibly are very hard to treat in any other way?
The model we use is liver cancer, and that's because I've worked on the liver for quite some time.
Mm-hmm.
Because my interest as a virologist stemmed from working a lot on hepatitis C,
right,
hepatitis C virus, which is one of the major causes of liver cancer. So what we published a few years ago was that using this reovirus and some other forms of viruses to stimulate immune responses against models of liver cancer, including those where hepatitis C was present. I stress these are only models, but that scenario is a very difficult thing to recapitulate in a laboratory. What we found was two things. One, that the virus does indeed cause an anti-cancer effect by the stimulation of immune responses. And actually, in addition, that the killed virus that I mentioned earlier works similarly in that scenario. But there is a secondary effect in that the immune responses that the adding the second virus, the reovirus, the therapeutic virus, to the system actually causes an enhanced antiviral response against the hepatitis C. So you're not only tackling the tumour itself, you're also tackling the virus that's driving that tumour forward. So we think that immune therapies in tumours that are caused by viruses themselves might be an interesting sort of nuance of these
tumors to target.
So we proved that for hepatitis C, also a model of hepatitis B and a model of Epstein-Barr virus, which I mentioned as a cause of blood cancer. So, yeah, it's a similar principle, and it all is fundamentally hanged around this idea that interferon is central to these responses, and that has antiviral properties, as you may know.
Right. Do you have, off the top of your head, the kind of proportion of cancers that are viral-based?
Sure. So, I mean, there are different estimates, but something between 20 and 30% of tumours are thought to be associated with virus infections. So, I mean, if you look at, you know, the majority of liver cancers across the world, which is one of the deadliest cancers in the planet, caused by either hepatitis B or hepatitis C. You have papillomavirus, of course, for cervical cancer and head and neck skin cancers, Epstein-Barr, many, many others. So, you know, viruses are a known source of cancer causation, and it's, you know, many of them cause it directly as well as indirectly through inappropriate activation of the immune response.
And I'm guessing that this proves as effective as you're hoping, that the stage of the cancer really isn't going to come into it, particularly, it's just as likely to help somebody with a late stage cancer as an early stage. Is that true?
Well, a late stage cancer that's metastasized and spread around the body is always going to be harder to treat.
Right.
However, we do know from other studies with oncolytic viruses, where, for example, the tumour's been injected with a virus, one tumour, you start to see regression in the other tumour sites as well.
Mm.
So if you achieve a what we call a systemic, so the whole body you know, response to that tumour, you can see it happening across multiple sites in the body.
Right.
So that is certainly achievable. And, of course, if you can administer your virus throughout the entire body, through the bloodstream, for example, then that is a good way of targeting things which you may or may not even be able to see on a scan, for example. So, you know, small metastatic tumours that are, you know, hard to pick up in various different tissues should be spotted by our immune response far better than a scan, for example. But, you know, there are nuances as to where your immune response is most effective. And of course, the more advanced the tumour, the more disordered and chaotic its growth patterns may be. So you may have to approach it with a more tougher therapeutic response. But certainly, yes, we would aim to tackle systemic disease by this strategy.
Which, of course, is the logic behind giving a lot of chemotherapy, particularly to late-stage cancer patients, which is not a walk in the park, is it at all? So this is a largely non-toxic treatment, is that fair?
The viruses themselves have been shown to be very, very, very mildly, very, very, very well tolerated by patients. And it's also something that are very well tolerated by cancer patients in particular. And let's remember, a lot of patients that have advanced cancer are in a very poor state of health.
Yes.
And for example, trials with the reovirus that we use, we have, you know, colleagues such as Alan Melcher, who I work with, they've done trials where you can infuse very large quantities of virus into the bloodstream of these patients with very, very mild effects, sort of a very raised temperature for a short period of time, for example. And that very rapidly resolves, and you still get the beneficial effects of that virus. So they're very well tolerated.
I mean, that is fantastic, because of course everybody knows that chemotherapies can be extremely damaging, quite apart from being a horrendous ride of side effects. You know, they can actually create permanent damage. So this is a very different ballpark.
The chemotherapy is itself very useful in many respects, because and actually, you know, you would look to potentially combine chemotherapy with viruses as well.
Right.
It really would be dependent on the tumour itself. But of course, you know, lessening toxicity is a huge goal in any cancer therapy.
Just nipping back for a second to something you were saying about the fact that this is a systemic treatment and you're seeing things happening in other parts of the body while you're targeting one particular primary, say. How much of that do you put down to the fact that, well, this stuff gets everywhere? And how much would you put it down to the abscopal effect, which is something which I always take an interest in? It seems to me a fascinating thing, which is this thing about you treat a cancer in one place and other tumours elsewhere actually respond.
Sorry, I'm not very familiar with that.
You're not? All right, okay. Well, I think it's a fascinating thing.
Yeah.
But it's actually documented.
I mean, is that linked to the immune response?
Well, yes, that's right, it is. The kind of theory, if you like, behind it is that, you treat a primary tumour, this wakes up the immune system to a certain extent, which then deals with other tumours elsewhere. So it's quite
sure, well, yeah,
documented, but it's not often capitalised on. So it's noted in things like radiotherapy.
Immunotherapy certainly seeks to achieve that, definitely. So the idea would be that, so it's oncolytic viruses are so called because the original concept was to do with them selectively replicating within and therefore killing the tumours themselves. And that does indeed happen to an extent depending on the virus that you use. And so that is a major application of these. And sure enough, direct injection of these viruses into tumours, which is one of the very many models that we look at, does do that. It will kill them. And you're right, because when you see death in those tumours, and if it's extensive death, beyond the sort of standard, you often get a lot of death of cells in tumours with a sort of what we call necrotic core in them. If you see that death and you break down the resistance of that tumour to the immune response there, you're liberating these targets that are associated with the tumour, these tumour-associated antigens, which will, again, as you say, primary immune response. And if the secondary tumours throughout the body are similar or the same, at least in that respect, to that parental tumour, then sure enough, your immune response should target those at the same time. So that's absolutely what you see, for example, when you do immunotherapy in melanoma. And there are other examples of that. So yes, that would certainly be the mechanism by which we would hope systemic responses would occur by administering these viruses. The viruses aren't necessarily reaching every part of your body and killing the tumours directly. There will be an extent of tumour death, less so, we think, with our killed virus. That's important to say. That's one reason why we think that the immune response itself is more important. But certainly you need a mechanism by which you're going to identify those targets in the tumour, your adaptive immune response to chase after it. So yeah, that's a very important effect, and you're right, that's an incredibly important aspect of targeting systemic tumours.
Right,
certainly.
Right. Okay, so you've already said very well tolerated. I mean, if there are to be side effects, what are they?
They're fairly mild, really. I mean, so it depends, on the virus that you're giving and the route by which you give it. It also can depend on whether you've already experienced an infection with this virus as well.
Right.
So the example that we use for reovirus, for example, is if we give it intravenously, you'll see a raised temperature and you'll see a small peak in liver enzymes because all your bloodstream goes through your liver, so you get what we call a transaminitis very mildly in certain patients, not many. Certain patients, and that's just literally the liver dealing with that virus. It goes away again very quickly. There seems to be a sort of as if almost like a vaccine reaction that some people might have, for example.
Right.
But it does depend on the virus. But it seems to be that even giving these very large doses of viruses are very well tolerated indeed.
Interesting. So quite unlike the bacteria in that way, because that was more like a trial by fever, wasn't that, where you're actually trying to induce a fever with the bacteria?
Well, that certainly is what occurs in these patients as well. But we do keep a very careful eye on them. They're monitored for any kind of effects. You know, so for recently, colleagues of mine in Leeds did a trial with brain tumour patients, for example.
Okay.
And they were tremendously closely monitored for any kind of adverse effects that the virus may be causing.
Mm.
Of course, with advanced cancer patients, you're possibly a little bit more tolerant of effects that you would accept compared with healthy patients in a trial, for example. But, you know, there is certainly no life-threatening or severe issues associated with those trials that I'm aware
Excellent.
Of.
Am I able to ask, how do we get on with the brain cancers?
Oh, well, that was just a very small, not very small, there's a larger study ongoing.
Mm-hmm.
That was what we call a window of opportunity study, where patients were given the virus just prior to them having their brain tumours removed surgically.
Right.
And so what we were looking for there is to see evidence that the virus had gone for those tumours in the brain.
Right.
And that was primary brain tumours as well as tumours that have metastasized to the brain as well.
Right.
And what we saw there, and this was published in Science Translational Medicine recently, was that, yes, you can indeed detect the virus there, and you can detect the stimulation of a response to that virus and against the tumours in some circumstances, and also that the tumour itself is upregulating these tricks that it plays to try and downregulate the immune response, which means that you can actually combine the virus, we think, with the antibody-mediated checkpoint inhibitor immunotherapies that people are quite familiar with. So again, it's sort of building that idea of a combinatorial approach to treating these cancers. And it was a really fantastic study, largely driven by my colleagues Adel Sampson and Anna Melcher, that achieved that.
Fantastic. So, you know, having new tools to use with the brain cancers is a great thing, isn't it? Because they're not so uncommon.
And Absolutely. They're
terrible cancer to have. And so many things don't actually get to the brain tumours, do they? Never get there. So to have a treatment that can get across the barrier is a gem. Mm. Okay, so... So viruses, they've got this kind of double-edged sword thing about it when it comes to cancer. They certainly seem to be at the root of some cancers, as we discussed, but they also show potential in the search for approaches to treating it. So I suppose this is true of many approaches to treating cancer. Of course, it's well known that most of the common treatments used today actually carry a risk of giving you cancer. So are there any risks in using viruses as a means to tackle cancer because of the fact they also cause them?
Well, I suspect it's unlikely that they would risk generating another cancer. That would be relatively unlikely. What you might risk is an immune-mediated pathology, so a sort of autoimmune type response. So that's quite common in antibody-mediated immunotherapies. People will develop colitis or hepatitis or skin reactions and things like that. Actually, interestingly, if that can be well managed, it usually is a sign that the immunotherapy is more likely to work, certainly anecdotally, and there are data on that, I think. So again, it's sort of harkening back to what you said about colis, you know, it's a sign that you are stimulating immunity. What the trick will be is to tailor those therapies more so that you don't get the adverse effects and you get the tumor-targeted effects without any kind of toxicity whatsoever. That's the utopia here.
Sure.
We would like to be able, and that's sort of more on the dendritic cell vaccine, CAR T cells, that sort of idea, where you're very much targeting the tumor. But the difficulty in that is, of course, that tumors evolve and change. So by being broad, you're kind of mitigating that aspect, but you run more of a risk of systemic toxicity.
Okay. As ever, it's complex, isn't it? There's never simple answers here. It's always a minefield working our way through it. Yeah. Okay. A quick question to get in before we finish. Are there any trials that the public can apply to join?
Sure. Yeah, there are several. Not necessarily just with the virus we use, reovirus. We're not at the stage of using our inactivated agent yet. That's going to be a few years in the making. But there are several trials, oncolytic virus trials ongoing things like modified vaccinia viruses in liver cancers, for example. There is a reovirus trial, actually, come to think of it, in brain cancers, running in the UK. There are many, many. If you look on clinicaltrials.gov, you'll and search for virus, you know, and oncolytic virus, you'll see several. And of course, you know, there are always trials exploring the efficacy of those things that already are. So, yeah, there are multiple aspects of that. And it's something we get asked quite a lot whenever we publish, you know, can I have access to this therapy?
Yeah.
My advice is to contact your clinician and to speak to them directly about potentially accessing a trial. Certainly places like the Marsden, overseen by people like Kevin Harrington, they run oncolytic virus trials and elsewhere in the country as well. So yes, it's important to do that. Leeds is a pretty large centre for that sort of clinical trial for oncolytic viruses, and my colleague Adil Sampson is running at least two at the moment, if I recall. So yeah, they are definitely ongoing.
That's great. Good to hear. Okay, well, this has been a fascinating talk. As I predicted, we could have gone on a lot longer, but anyway, I feel I've learned a huge amount, and I'm certain that many of our listeners will greatly appreciate you sharing your expertise with us. So thanks so much, Steve.
Thank you, Robin. I hope it made some sense, and
it did.
Yeah, we'll keep you posted going forward.
Excellent. Thank you. Bye-bye.
All right. Cheers.
Well, I loved hearing all about the work going on at Leeds and elsewhere. Very encouraging. There seems to be great potential for powerful new ways to combat cancer that are largely non-harmful, which we desperately need. The last couple of weeks, I've been drawing your attention to one of the great new features of the Yes to Life website, the searchable show page. If you haven't already taken a look, please do. Go to yestolife.org.uk and click the link to the Yes to Life show that's on the homepage. There you can search the archive of over 250 shows for topics or guests that interest you. And while you're there, do also look at another great new feature of the site, the upgraded Life Directory of Therapies and Providers of Integrative Medicine. Click the link to Providers and Therapies that's also on the homepage, and you'll be able to search the vast store of information to find therapists or providers to help you. Just try the What's Nearby feature to instantly find services within a specified distance of your home. And you can also do more sophisticated searches, say, for providers of medicinal herbs or mistletoe in the Midlands and the north of England. And if you want to get the most out of the directory, there's a short how-to video on the start page. We're really pleased with these new features and sincerely hope that they prove as useful to you as we intended. Thanks for listening today. I hope you found the talk as interesting as I did, and will be able to join me again at the same time next week for another Yes to Life show on UK Health Radio. Goodbye.